Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
So today we have our lovely Psychobabble team coming together once again. My name's Joey Pimes. I'm a psychotherapist in the South Island of New Zealand.
And I'm Ros Nealon-Cook, a former psychologist in the Blue Mountains in Australia.
And I'm Rene de Monchy, psychiatrist in Tauranga, New Zealand.
And so we thought we'd start today with something just a little bit different. We thought we'd begin with a very simple 3-minute grounding exercise, a grounding exercise with a special emphasis on the heart and the heart resonance. So Ros has volunteered to take us all through a very simple 3-minute grounding meditation. And if you're driving, please keep your eyes open.
I invite everyone to, just for a brief moment, gently close your eyes and bring your awareness to the area of your heart. If it's helpful, you might like to gently place your hand on your chest over the heart area. And just notice your breathing. And you may notice that with each out-breath, your heart rate is slightly slowing down and bringing more peace into your soul. You may also notice that within each in-breath, your heart rate is very slowly increasing. And this is the way that our bodies, our heart, work so beautifully to bring balance into our body. And see if you can extend the out-breath for 3 breaths, bringing your awareness to that calm and slowing down experienced in your body. This simple act of extending our out-breath is a beautiful tool that we can use whenever we want to bring more peace and harmony into our lives. And taking your time now, whenever you are ready, I invite you to gently open your eyes.
Oh, thank you so much, Ros. That's got us all nicely grounded and centered and ready for a great show. And I think we've come together today with a particular focus, and we have been discussing what we wanted to focus on, haven't we? And we sort of landed on the idea of balance. Go on, Rene.
We were going also to talk briefly that I wanted to make a correction about the last thing, to thank the people in the hospital.
We thank them too, Rene. It's so wonderful to see you so beautifully alive and well and in back in your power.
Well, I'll second that. Rene, is there anything you'd like to say about the or to the staff at the Christchurch Hospital?
It was Christchurch Hospital. It was the coronary care unit or the cardiology department. And yes, I have to say something because it is easy for people to construct our talks as sort of highly critical or even anti-medicine or anti-psychiatry. And I want to right from the beginning say that that is not what either of the three of us are actually wanting to happen. It is just to question and to bring the people in their personal responsibility and autonomy, and as a doctor then also to work in a cooperation, in a partnership actually with the patient. And so I want to say that because it may not have come through clear enough last time, that I am intensely grateful for the cardiology department in Christchurch and of the whole of the service at Christchurch Hospital, how they have treated me literally from the cleaner to the head cardiologist. I have the greatest gratitude, otherwise I wouldn't be here. And their skill, their professionalism, as well as their compassion was extraordinary. And often we hear only the negative things about the health system. And I can vouch for that as well, because working in the hospital myself, I can see how the health system is on the brink of collapse in the way of how it wants to work, and sheer pressure and lack of staff is only able to work. So in that context, the fact what I encountered in the cardiology department was so opposite to what we hear otherwise. And I simply wanted to have that said. So it's the same as I said last time. The staff and the doctors and the nurses, they are really very compassionate and loving people and skillful people. It is the system. It is really the whole thinking behind the system that is utterly wrong, in my opinion.
What I was thinking as you were saying that, René, and I can't agree more, that the vast majority of people working in these traditional medical fields are beautiful human beings and professionals, inordinately competent and compassionate. And I think it's sort of a baby and bathwater situation, isn't it? Yeah. I heard of a friend yesterday who lives in Perth, and her partner was bitten by a shark. Now, if you're bitten by a shark or you have an extreme cardiac event, you don't want to go to a Chinese healer or a Reiki master. They might say otherwise, but our allopathic medicine is absolutely perfect when we have these acute situations. And I think it's a really interesting sort of lead in to talking about balance, because it's not an either or. It's not binary that allopathic medicine is good or bad, or traditional or complementary medicine, as we might call it, is good or bad. It's both. And I believe it's more about the reformation of the system rather than hopefully the collapse, where we can come out of this division and see how all of these different pictures can fit together beautifully to keep us all in balance.
Well, I do wonder, Roz, whether they can all fit together. I think there are also some direct conflicts in philosophy and approach, that there are such deep philosophical differences that have to be, as it were, accommodated. In the same way that I think allopathic medicine, that's conventional medicine, needs to humble itself somewhat, in my opinion, from the position of supreme arrogance, yes, over-empowering funding, complete and unquestioning support by the government, and a fair amount of absolutely mind-boggling brainwashing that's been going on for the last 100 years or so. And I think they need to humble themselves with what's happening and eat humble pie publicly, and apologize publicly, because that's the system that has, in fact, enacted one of the most horrific, murderous, genocidal behaviors upon the human race in the history of our planet. So it is time for a humbling. That doesn't mean to say if I got bitten by a shark, I wouldn't be the first queuing up at the A&E department. And I think I would get really well cared for to the best of their ability, as Renee said. But there are some fundamental differences, because a whole bunch of healers that have been going for thousands of years have been ridiculed, ostracized, outed, attacked. So I do understand why people might, carte blanche, throw the baby out with the bathwater, because the history has been so unbalanced. But I also think that we need to acknowledge that within the alternative or the traditional medicine sectors, there is a need for a massive amount of support and holding up. And to some extent, a much greater level of professionalism is needed, in my opinion, in those more traditional areas. Because I tell you, one of the things that allopathic medicine has absolutely nailed, and that has been how to really do the research, how to really, you know, hunker down and have, deliver a professional service, because they've been in the public eye. Whereas many of the alternative traditional practitioners have been able to, and I'm one of them, have been able to, well, before I qualified as a psychotherapist, I would say I was one of them, but, we could get by quite sloppily, actually, quite badly in our private practices without the challenge of public scrutiny. So I think there's so much to be gained from both sides, but the side that has the arrogance and the pride that wishes to put down the traditional side is not the traditional side doing that, and we need to recognize that. So that's my Absolutely. Balancing argument. We're talking about balance today. That's my balancing argument.
It's absolutely right. And it is actually, it is not long since the word health industry actually came into being used. I remember when I was young, we had a town of probably about 50,000 people then, and I think there were four or five doctors there, because people went to the doctor when there was a need, and the doctor helped with that and was part of the family in a way. But since then, it has become completely commercialized. Mm. And therefore, then we have, as doctors, sold our soul, actually, to the, on the one hand, bureaucracy, and on the other hand, to the pharmaceutical interests. And that has come into the sacred dyad of patient-doctor that Hippocrates talked about, and that we all as doctors actually literally swore the oath on, and that has been completely perverted. So we need to find a whole new way of working together in the whole health field with all practitioners, but with a degree of self-reflection as well as need for compassion for other views, but also with a clarity of thought, and as well as a compassionate heart. And I think often it seems as if it's seen as medicine is only brain and alternative medicine is only heart. Neither of those two is true.
Yes, 100%. A point I'd just like to reflect on, Jerry, you raised the point about the arrogance of the medical profession, and certainly that's something we've seen in spades the last few years. However, again, coming back to this sort of perspective-taking Sellyann task, I would like to, and I'm not a medical doctor, but I still would like to raise the awareness that the vast majority of them aren't acting malevolently towards I don't even like the word alternate. What is it? Traditional medicine. They were trained, and their entire worldview was sponsored by pharma. certainly in the last 50 or so years. So their whole education was telling them that this was all nonsense. So I'd just like to, yeah, sort of extend an olive branch to them. The other point was regarding research. Yes, the allopathic medicine is very good at research. However, let's not forget the, we call them impact one journals, impact factor one. So the top medical journals, such as the New England Journal of Medicine, the Lancet, the BMJ, British Medical Journal, it's been shown again and again that they're compromised. And that's the piece, again, it has to be education rather than demanding apologies from doctors who have no idea. They need to be educated, not shamed, but our compassion and empathy towards them, because this is going to blow their minds when they find out. Really, that was one of our first conversations, wasn't it, Jerry? Our fear that when some of the doctors find out just how much subversion, corruption, et cetera, there's been, there's a real risk of widespread mental health collapse for those doctors and, you know, possible suicide ideation, et cetera.
Absolutely. And that is just terrible. And that's also why the previous editor of the New England Journal of Medicine has resigned a few years ago, and actually Dr. Engel, and she also wrote a book about this, how completely corrupted the medical journals are because of their interest. And so I go one way further. I think the way of medicine as it is at the moment is a dead-end street. And people start to walk with their feet.
Yeah. Marcia Angel, if I could just say, because I love her, Renee, she's quite an inspirational person. I think she was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine for 20 or 30 years. And she publicly wrote, I simply cannot in good conscience do this for any longer. So I really encourage any listeners who are interested in this, go and look her up. Dr. Marcia Angel is her name.
How do you spell Angel?
A-N-G-E-L-L.
And what's the book, Renee? What book did she write? Do you remember? Does anyone know?
I'm looking it up right now.
You look it up now. That would be wonderful. I think the listeners might be very interested in that. While you're doing that, Renee, I'm just going to say that you're listening to Psychobabble, and this is our monthly gathering to discuss issues, all issues really, issues of health, issues of psychological well-being, issues of medicine, issues of healing, what we think is going on, what we think isn't going on. And we've got René de Monchy, a psychiatrist and psychotherapist in the North Island. We've got Ros Neelan-Cook from Sydney, who calls herself an ex-psychologist. I'm still trying to get my head around how you unpsychologist yourself. I'm trying to think, do you have to go on a special university degree course to unpsychology yourself?
It is an interesting concept, and it was one that I fought for a while and then decided to give up. It turns out, and it's probably the same in New Zealand and the rest of the world, our government sort of bureaucracy heads of health professionals called ARPRA, they actually own the terms, the titles, psychologist, anything that ends with an ist, they own. And if you don't have their registration, and if you continue using that moniker, you're potentially facing criminal charges, as they wrote to me many times and told me. And so I lost my title because they took my license away for speaking out about the psychological damages and fallout, collateral damage from all the COVID government policies. So, yes, there were a lot of people who were very up in arms on my behalf and said, just call yourself a psychologist. But I was sent many, many letters and threatened with legal action if I continued to do so, even up to the point, and this is just shows the utter stupidity of it, they were following me on social media, and one of the tweets that I had done had the hashtag psychologist, and they said by implication that was suggesting I was still a registered psychologist, and if I didn't change it, they'd send me pages and pages looking at all my socials. It's really incredible when you think about the amount of energy they put into that rather than looking at the issues we're raising and putting resources into that. They don't. They're like toddlers just wanting to be right and locking in and not considering other viewpoints.
I'm just going to give you the title of Marcia Angel. So Marcia and then A-N-G-E-L-L. And she has written The Truth About the Drug Companies. And she's written Science on Trial. The Truth About the Drug Companies in 2004 and Science on Trial in 1996.
Mm. I think her first piece was a editorial piece for the New York Times, which used to be a very different beast. So that can be a starting point for people that may not want to dive immediately into the book.
Yep, that's true. We talked a lot about medicine, and that was actually not at all my intention. It was just going to be to thank the Christchurch people, because we wanted to talk about balance, and that is exactly what Ross started off, actually, with this little meditation that we did, the balance between in and out breathing, the balance between macrocosmos, microcosmos, the balance between heart and head, and how the heart sits there, rhythmizing that balance. So that's what we actually wanted to talk about.
Well, just to get us in the groove for a bit of balanced discussion, I'd like to suggest we take a short music break. And I've got a wonderful piece of music that I've come across by Sarah Tavares called Balance. It's a beautiful piece of music. It's a Portuguese lady. Well, in fact, she comes from Cape Verde Islands, which I love and have visited on several occasions. And it's a beautiful, beautiful piece. And the song has the words, balance, yay, balance, yeah. So you get this whole A and the R in the song. It's a very lovely piece. I hope everyone gets out of their chairs, or if they're driving, start bouncing in your seat and doing a bit of seat dancing while you're driving. Don't tell anyone I said that. So let's have a listen to Sarah Tavares. Balance, yay, balance, yeah. That was Balance by Sarah Tavares. What do you think, René?
And I'm delighted to hear that you visited the Cape Verdean Islands. And that brings me right back off when I was at age 16. I signed on a tramp ship to Central America. And wow. I was a deckhand there and cleaning the toilets and all of that, together with a Cape Verdean young man, Sergio Montero. And I remember him. And so we were actually both young boys. And on that big voyage over the Atlantic Ocean and the big wide world together. Now, he did it obviously because he needed. He needed to get a job, and there was nothing on the Cape Verdean Islands. I could do it as a sort of a holiday job.
I think every young person should do a job like that, René. I think there's so much incredible life experience. I didn't know you'd done that previously, and you know, look at you now, you're a psychiatrist with all this incredible experience, but you started off swabbing decks and cleaning toilets. There's nothing more important for us all to go through and experience those real jobs.
Well, while we're on the issue of humility, which is a subplot that's already emerging out of our discussions, really, or the lack thereof, I think what's very interesting is that one of the most important things is René has been someone who has struck me right from the beginning as very humble. And it's an endearing quality in everyone. And whenever we meet anyone who has a humility, it's always a restful place to be, because there's no competitive one-upmanship kind of going on. And it's why I love this panel, because we kind of accept each other as a beginning position. But what's really interesting to me is you talk about humility. I don't think there's anything more humbling than cleaning toilets. And I think that my training for all medical doctors would be their first year of training should be to clean the bloody toilets in the hospital. And I think at that point, they would arrive after their first year of training, having a real understanding of how dependent they at the so-called sort of top of the pile are on the people who do the jobs at the so-called bottom of the pile. And how actually we're all at the same level, because if those toilets aren't kept clean, and if the surfaces and the environment is not clean properly, you won't have very good medicine in that environment. I mean, that's been going since the time of Charles Lister in 1840, 50, I don't remember exactly when. But what I'm trying to say is when I was running training courses in the UK, I had to visit many, many hotels to find out, A, whether they had a big enough space. And I never knew what kind of management I was dealing with. And I knew that my courses depended on the whole team in the hotel, you know, how people were greeted when they walked in. The whole experience of coming on a training course with people you don't know. And I wanted to make it as warm as possible. And we always had our meeters and greeters. We did that. But when I was checking out hotels, I wanted to be in an environment where I felt care. So while my colleague was discussing with the manager, we'd go in, we'd have an appointment with them. The only place I visited, after we'd seen the main rooms, I would make a point of visiting the toilets. And she, being a female, she would visit the women's toilets. And then before we made any decisions, we discussed how well the toilets were kept. Because I figured if the toilet staff were properly valued and honored, they would be given enough time to do it and support in doing a great job. And if that was the kind of management that was operational, that was the hotel for me. So toilet cleaning, right in there.
It also gives you a not only humbling, but a unique window into the human world. I cleaned toilets in a pub in London when I was 18. And the things you see in a pub in the toilets are not so great, but it does. It is a very, believe it or not, grounding experience, isn't it? Because you get to see the foibles of humanity. But interestingly, I really do, not just doctors, I think all children, all young people should have that experience. And it's actually, just quickly going off on a tangent, I went on a meditation family weekend many years ago, and we all had to help out with the cleaning. And we were instructed to really bring our heart and our focus onto what the job it was we were given, rather than, you know, just having to clean whatever or having to cook and being resistant to it, which many of us are. And I was given the job of cleaning the toilet blocks. And so I did absolutely brought sort of everything into this job. And I remember I got to the point where I was enraptured by the bubbles of the cleaning solution as I was cleaning these toilets, and it actually became a beautiful thing. That might sound crazy to some listeners, but give it a go.
No, I think it's actually perfectly right. And it is also, anything can be, just like life itself is actually a meditation, and every tiniest detail of that is that too. The way, if you look with wonder and awe even at the bubbles of water. And I know that that's in Tibetan medicine. One of the things is to actually look at the bubbles of the urine. And so all of these things, and I always feel that, just briefly coming back in medicine, medicine should actually be the most compact, the most wonderful way to learn humility. Because you're working the whole day with this completely mystery of the human being. And so if medicine becomes arrogant, then you know, or if a doctor becomes arrogant, he or she has actually perverted the science of healing. Because it's that awe and admiration, that is what a child has by nature. Mm. And then we all have that within us. But our conditioning, etc., almost weeds it out in order for goals to be achieved or to go to school, education, university, etc. And then to regain that actually by conscious effort to say, I don't want to be restricted like that. I actually need to regain that awe and humility. Many of our of people in this age can't do that. And yet, that is exactly what we talked about last time, what illnesses, what crises, what things do, because it stops you in your track. Mm. Am I on the right way?
Mm. Mm. Are we going to get to homeostasis, Jerry?
We are, but you know, and keeping us on topic is rather like trying to herd wild cats. I just want to say that as an aside. And you know what? I think the listeners rather enjoy us riffing off at our tangents because I think they're very real and they're very grounded. I certainly find great value in hearing about you cleaning the rim of a toilet, Roz, and Rene on his tramp ship. Now, neither of those would have turned up, but I think this is part of life. And one of the things I like, and I don't want to get too eulogizing about our panel, but one of the things I like about us is we're kind of quite grounded and we like to keep things very much down to earth. And I think what you've just said, Rene, is very down to earth, as is my next statement, which is, I think I said that you were about 182 years old, didn't I, on a previous program, Rene? But in fact, I gather you're only 78 years old. Is that correct?
Well, that is, of course, what is age? Now we go into quite philosophical, but chronologically, you're right, 78.
Well, I'm glad I put that right, and I do apologize for getting your age wrong.
That's right.
It's like pronouncing someone's name wrongly, isn't it? Should we get on to homeostasis? No, shall we get on to balance?
Balance. Yes, but I think we need the concept of homeostasis introduced early on because it's everything.
Well, who's going to define homeostasis then? Who's going to be brave enough to jump in with a definition of homeostasis?
Okay, there was, when I did my house surgeon year in Holland, and there was one very old doctor, and he actually, he was not at all interested in medicine anymore. And he was the despair of his registrar who would, let's say, call in the middle of the night about a patient who was terribly poorly and going to die, etc. And he said, well, Dr. F was his name. What should I do? Just look after the homeostasis. And so this registrar was absolutely in despair because that's what he'd been trying to do, but this patient was dying and he wanted to get some advice. And of course, in some sense, the advice, keep the homeostasis, is absolutely right. But it didn't mean anything in the practical terms of you need to give him some blood transfusion or you need to do this, that, and the other. So the word homeostasis simply means to keep in balance. Homeo is same. Stasis is to stand, to stand on the same balance.
Yes, and I think it's important to understand that our bodies are absolutely fantastic at trying to keep ourselves in this homeostatic point. And it's really all about balance and whether we're talking about our physical self, our emotional self, our mental self, it's about keeping us in a sort of optimal state amidst the, you know, the constant changes of life. And I think this is such an important point these days because we're living with so much stress and so much confusion. And of course, there's a lot of pain for many of us as well. So for me, the most important point with balance and homeostasis is, again, the psychoeducation piece. It's the awareness of it. And I think, again, understanding how we operate really gives us that extra sort of power to almost hack our systems. One of my favorite examples for talking about balance is tennis players. Have you considered it from this point? So tennis players, if you, and we've all seen them, know, Djokovic, bless his heart, when they're waiting for a serve and they bounce from foot, from left to right. And the reason they're doing that is that they are keeping themselves in a balanced state so that they're ready to react whichever way that ball comes. They can go left or they can go right. And so really with balance, again, it's not about a sort of steady flat line. It's about continuous adjustments in our body, in our eyes, in our inner ears, when we're talking about the physical nature. But when we start coming into the emotional realm and how we keep balance in times of adversity, we have, actually, I'll just mention the heart in this, because just like with the physical state, our heart is also constantly seeking balance. So as with the meditation, the quick breathing exercise that we did, our heart rate isn't at a constant 60 beats or whatever your resting heart rate is per minute. Every time we breathe in, our heart rate goes up maybe 3 to 5 beats. And every time we exhale, it reduces by 3 to 5 beats. And this again is keeping us in preparation, so ready to meet whatever challenging situations might come our way. For example, if a car suddenly comes careering towards us, our heart is ready to put us into fight flight and very quickly pull the resources so that we can jump out of the way. And these fluctuations in heartbeats are really incredibly important for our emotional well-being as well. So just with the heart and the body, our psychology is also seeking balance so that we can function at our best. And one of the best models for this, and I'm hoping we might be able to put a link, Jerry, in the notes, is a very well-known, I think he's a psychiatrist, Dr. Dan Siegel. And he has come up with a model called the window of tolerance. And it's all about understanding our own levels of arousal, making sure that we're in the optimal zone so we can deal with difficult situations really effectively. And there's no more important time I can think of than having those skills and that understanding at this point in history. And he talks about 3 levels of arousal in this window of tolerance. So we've got our optimal zone. And when we're working from this optimal zone, we can think clearly, we can process emotions, we can connect with others, and we're feeling safe. However, on each end of these zones, we have 2 other states that can be quite problematic. And we have what's called the hyperarousal state. And that is when we might be feeling very anxious, overwhelmed, and we can't process information properly. And certainly many, many of us in the last 4 years have been operating in that state of hyperarousal or hypervigilance. And then at the other end, we have the hypoarousal state. And this one is more of a sort of state of collapse where we are numb, we're disconnected, we're depressed. And again, we can't process information effectively. And really, we're probably not even interested in engaging with different information. And I think, again, in these last 4 years, and I've spoken, I'm someone who's very open about my own psychology. I know in the last 6 months or so, and I've only realized this recently, I've moved into more of a hypoarousal state. And that might be really a very common theme with the listeners. As I said before, we've been so anxious and in that fight, flight, hyperarousal state for so many years that we've used up all our resources. We're burnt out. And it's incredibly important to notice which state you're in so that then you can take corrective action.
Yeah, if I may what you say is a beautiful example that I would like to show how the thyroid gland is actually doing right that. And it's interesting, if you look at the word thyroid, is derived from the Greek word thurios, shield. And the word in Dutch and in German is schildklier, shielding gland. And if you look at where that is sitting, it is sitting here in front of my organ of verbal expression, the larynx. And it sits there to shield that. And it has very much to do with the I and outside world, how we come into relationship together. So if you have a hyperthyroidism, so a too fast, too hard working thyroid, means that it is on the continuous alert. It's like the deer in the bush. It's all sense organ. And the pathology of hyperthyroidism is this exophthalmos, these popping out eyes, this being completely sense organ to the extreme that you also get inwardly, you get palpitations, you get diarrhea, you get all these things and nervousness or whatever. And it's interesting that the opposite is hypothyroidism. Hypothyroidism meaning a degree of dullness that you get, an apathy, a tiredness, often constipation. And you can already hear it in my voice, the difference between hyperthyroid and hypothyroid. We also talk about the hypothyroid idiocy, if that would be from birth, that you have actually that intellectual disability. And what do we see at the moment? And I've seen that as a GP, but certainly in the last few years and more, we see that hypothyroidism, which is exactly what you talk about, Ros, this lowering down of the energy. And my view on that, and I haven't read that anywhere, but that's my own experience view, that it is actually a burned out hyperthyroidism from the bombardment of the senses and the bombardment on the physical body to lose the homeostasis. And the thyroid says, look, I can't do it anymore. I don't make enough T4 and T3 anymore. And I externally need that. So I just this as an example of exactly what you talk about.
And I think what's really interesting there, Renee, thank you for bringing that point. I hadn't thought about the thyroid in this way, but I certainly know, and I'm sure most of us do, so many friends and family members who are put onto medication because of thyroid issues. And again, not saying that those medications might not have a place, but again, if we bring in this balance of looking at how the allopathic and the traditional healing modalities can help, because what people need is to calm their nervous systems.
I was going to say, why don't we take a little music break right now? And after the music, how about we come back and discuss some of the practical implications for our listeners of this concept of hyperarousal, hypoarousal, and balance or homeostasis, finding that middle ground. Sound good?
I have a song about that.
You have a song about that? Brilliant.
Well, yes. And it's actually a song by Paul Weller, W-E-L-L-E-R. And it is called Equanimity. Because that's really what we talk about. The human being in his or her uprightness to stand in the, like a strong rock in the storm of life. And the thyroid does that physically, the adrenals do that, all of that, our physical body wants to do that. And so this song, Equanimity, so let's do that.
Let's have a listen. So that was Paul Weller and Equanimity. What did you think? Did you enjoy that piece of music? We're here in Psychobabble. You're listening to Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair. And we have our monthly Psychobabble panel. We've got Betty, Bob, and Billy Babble, I think, is this.
I love it.
Or the other way we sometimes like to say it is we've got three psychos babbling, two turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. So we have been talking about balance. And if you've just joined us, balance and homeostasis and the idea that there are these middle places, both physically and mentally and emotionally. And we're going to move on and talk now about the implications or how can we make use of this information in a practical way. And Roz, I'm going to pass that baton right over to you to begin with, and we'll discuss it between the three of us.
Thanks, Jerry. I think, as before, the most important point is to have that awareness around your own window of tolerance. And importantly, to realize it's a window. A window is actually not fluctuating, isn't it? But this one is. It changes. And with that, that gives us enormous opportunity to increase our optimal functioning zone. The things that really impact the window are things we've talked about previously and will keep coming back to, I'm sure. You can imagine in your own life, if you've had very poor sleep, if you haven't exercised, if you're not eating well, if you haven't been out in nature, if you're isolated, your window of tolerance contracts. And what that means is that things that might otherwise not bother you so much will bother you more. And we've all had that experience, a bad night's sleep, and we can become a lot more escalated. So really do focus on those issues. They are so incredibly important. And not only that, but really consider what media you're consuming, because so much of the, not only the mainstream media, but even the media, the alternative media is often focused on fear. It's focused on all of these things that put us in that hyper-aroused state. And I know a lot of people think it's important to be aware of everything that's going on, but so much of it is specifically targeted, very sadly, to keep people in that aroused state. And if you're constantly in a place of fear and anger and terror, you're never going to be able to operate from that most effective zone. So what I always suggest to people is first thing in the morning and also last thing at night, just do a little check-in. It doesn't have to be long. Do a self-inventory. How was I operating today? Did I become hyper-aroused? Am I lacking motivation and hypo-aroused? And then if that's the case, there's all sorts of particular things you can do to either lower your arousal, or if you're hypo-aroused, to increase your arousal. I'm sure we all have a lot to say on this, but I think the most powerful for both is music. And there's music that's beautifully calming if you're feeling very over-escalated. And then there's nothing better. I always love having a dance in the kitchen when I'm doing my housework or cleaning if I'm not feeling too good, because it is so wonderful for not only regulating your heartbeat, your mood, but invariably puts a smile on your face too. And that's one of many. I'll open this up to you both now.
Well, I think your suggestion of monitoring yourself and regulating yourself is absolutely perfect, Roz. And that's why we keep playing music on this show, because some of the subjects, even though we're talking about them in a friendly, collegial and friendship environment, I think there are triggers in almost everything we talk about. And so having music that we know can, as it were, discharge the triggering and release the body and allow the body to move and to, we can get up and dance. Or sometimes, as you say, music that takes us right down into draws us into a calm place. And we could talk for hours about how different pieces of music work. But I am also wondering about the fascination that I feel sometimes when I know I'm not needing it, but I can't resist scrolling through and finding the latest piece of terrible information. And I wondered if Roz, or certainly either you or Renee, might have something to say so we can understand this almost hardwired impulse to seek out terrible news, because that's how newspapers sell, right? And I wonder if either of you would like to talk to that. We haven't planned this, but it just came up to me that listeners might find it really valuable to understand why that impulse is there and how to counter it, because I think it's a primary problem for a lot of us.
Mm. Yeah, I think that is very true. I just want to go one step back when Ross was talking about music and movement, and the same of the tennis player moving. If you look at music, it has actually got two components in it. It's rhythm and melody. And so the importance of rhythm, and even if you look at the chakras and all the organ systems in our body, they work in a sort of rhythm, just like nature rhythms and the seasons and the eclipse that the sun makes around the earth, etc. And in our day rhythm of the various organs. But the importance of us to come in a rhythm, and I see that with my patients, really trying to get them into the simplest rhythm of going to bed at a certain time, waking up at a certain time, having meals at a certain time. That is the simplest. And then with the meals, realizing that that is not just to pour something into your stomach for your digestive system. No, eating has always been a social aspect in all cultures. So to make that into a social happening, not sitting in front of the TV at the 6 o'clock news to hear all the atrocities in Ukraine and Gaza and Congo, but actually to take your time for that and to do all that in a regularity and a rhythm, to come into that. And that means that that takes also a degree of discipline to hold that rhythm. And with that combination of rhythm, regularity, and discipline, you actually strengthen that equanimity and that homeostasis, both physically and emotionally and mentally, to that extent that you can actually hold far more of the things that come to you. So if I am balanced and I hear all the various things that come to me, then I can filter out a bit better, and taking my stance in that, rather than being controlled by the news or by the fear or by this or that. So I experience it, but it does not control me. Mm. And the problem, I think, in our age is that we are controlled by all these things, by our outer perceptions, by the and that's in all areas. I mean, that's visually. They have just put up here in very close to my house these huge billboards that change every 3 seconds in very bright colors and things, day and night. So that's visual. In the way of sound, there is no longer the stillness. Actually, I should have chosen Hello Darkness, My Old Friend.
Yes.
Come to You Again. Perhaps we should use that as one of my musics. Because that inner stillness that we have, that stillness within the heart, and I've written a poem once about that, about the actually how the Trinity is working in between the contraction, which brings conscious, and the dilatation of the heart. And then, just like the center of the lemniscate, that point of nothingness or allness, like between high tide and low tide, that time just between day and night, that split second, that is actually where health lies. And we as human beings can do that consciously. But we need to do that. If we want to really survive in this world of bombardment, in this world of wanting to control us on all sides, we need to find that pillar of light, as I call that, that center, and that is stillness, that is peace, that's where healing lies.
Wow, you've said so many amazing points there, Rene. There's so many directions to go. I want to just share with you, I learned drumming, to use African drumming as a therapy for children. And the teacher who we had, who was this incredible young man, and his whole thesis was that the power within the drumming, the power within the music, it's nothing to do with what beats you choose. The power is exactly what you've said. It's the gap. It's the pause in the middle. That is where the gold is. And with the in and the out breath, it's the same. It's the pause. That's where the power and the balance actually lies.
I'd like to riff off that one, if I may, Roz. The one thing I've done more than anything in my life, actually, has been giving body work. I started as a young man and became, in many ways, completely addicted to the act of both giving and as well as receiving as well. I always knew it was important for me to experience, and all my students, you could recognize my students because they were the most massage therapists anywhere, because I required them to have as much, you know, at least a weekly massage if they were giving massage. And what was really interesting is in the system of massage that I developed that was called No Hands, because it was developed from injury, I couldn't actually use my hands. I developed a way of working through the forearms, but the soft parts. Everyone says, oh yeah, I use my elbows. And I go, why would you do that? Don't you like your clients? You know, because if you use your elbows on someone, it's really not nice. So I do very gentle, there's a thick piece of skin, everyone can feel it. If you just feel above your elbow in the lower arm, and you just feel right close to the elbow, just towards the hand from the elbow, there's this really thick piece of flesh. If you clench your fist, you can feel it bulging. All right. And then you relax and flop the wrist and it goes all soft. So my whole approach very quickly depended, because I learned it by accident. But I found myself, because I couldn't use my hands, they both got injured on the same day. I found myself falling onto my clients through these beautiful, soft areas. And slowly, slowly, gently, gently dropping my weight into the client's tissues. And if there was any kind of hardening or reaction, I could come out. So it was always a very much a listening kind of touch. When I taught it in Taiwan, they had this beautiful banner across the stage when I was presenting it. And it looked beautiful in all these Chinese characters. And I thought, wow, they're doing a great job, you know, promoting me. And my ego was getting really pumped up with pride at all my great fame. And here I was, you know, I'd made it to the stage. And then I made the mistake of asking the person that was translating for me. I made the mistake of asking them what it said. And it said, English style falling over massage.
Brilliant.
But the reason I'm sharing this is because I developed a discipline which I was repeating. A great deal of my treatments would literally involve simply, we called it slumping, falling in very, very gently and slowly without any strain to ourselves. Always the client could just, you know, stop if there was too much pressure. But it was amazing how much pressure the clients could have, because it was so soft and it was so gentle, so that the nervous system was able to receive it or to block it. And we learned how to feel that. So we were dropping in very, very slowly, sometimes probably over, you know, the duration of this sentence, actually. And then there would be this coming out again. There was no hanging around in this compressed place. It was almost like, that's the most I'm going to do. That's what you get. And then I just gently ebb away. And so I had to train myself and others to drop the hips, and the weight would slowly come away from the back. Now, what was really interesting about this, and I didn't know it at the time, was what was being enacted, of course, was a very rhythmic, and what you have been saying, Renee, a very rhythmic but slow ebb and flow. And there was this kind of movement away, and there was this movement in. And what we all realized from being clients mainly, what we realized is that when we were coming away, that was when the body seemed to be freed to expand or to circulate or to in some way alter its patterns of rhythm or flow of energy. And so there were these kind of moments of dropping in and then like an out-breath. So at the end of the out-breath, there's what I call the second stage of the breath, which is the turnaround. Mm. How long before, when we breathed out to our satisfaction, how long before we breathe in again? Mm. And then when we breathe in and we came up, sometimes when the arms would literally come off the body, even though the client was very aware that we were still there, they would come off momentarily. And there would be this kind of precious moment of almost a pause, as you described, Renee, like a pause moment. And then once again, there was this falling. And for the clients, they'd never experienced such weight, because by the end of the falling, all the practitioner's body weight was on them. There wasn't anything left. You know, if you took away the client, the practitioner would fall flat on the floor. All their body weight was on the client. And so there was this ebb and flow. And I was actually moved to write a poem about this. I was so immersed in it. And I just felt that in that moment between the going in and the coming out, the balance, in that moment, something amazing was happening. Something rushed out of the client to meet me, and something in me rushed to meet the client. It was as if, because of the gentleness of it, because of the slowness of it, because of the respectfulness of it, and because of the non-imposition of it, there was no, I'm giving you a treatment. This is like, just let me know how this feels. You know, very, very nice, respectful environment. There was this beautiful kind of falling and fallen. And it was never really clear to me quite what was ever going on, but it always felt amazing. It was hard to find words for it. It was very spiritual. It was very energetic. And it felt like at those moments, for me, and I tend towards the hyper. You know, I love activity. I love to be an action man. I love all of that stuff. Mm. Well, when I worked and my clients arrived, this is when I would start to slow down and get into this rhythmic ebb and flow. Mm. And when COVID came, and many of my massage therapists got sick because we were no longer able to give the treatments because we were not allowed to because of lockdowns. And it was a really clear example because I had an association of over 500 massage therapists, all of whom had been trained to work this way by me. Mm-hmm. And what was amazing was the level of sickness because these people were used to being in this flow, yes, 10, 20 times a week for a whole hour each time. That's like, yeah, 20 meditations a week. Anyway, mm-hmm, I wanted to share that because it's a very practical way. It's not that I want everyone to necessarily do body work. It's just that sense of the tide, the ebb and the flow that you described, mm-hmm, Renee, is so important. Mm-hmm.
It is so important, Jerry. And I'm wondering if what you've described so beautifully is actually with these clients reaching their resonant frequency. I'm not sure if that's something you thought about, but resonant frequencies exist throughout nature. But the one I think is particularly potent here is the resonant frequency between our heart and our breathing. And that's the frequency at which point we sort of explode into well-being, we power up, we go into flow. And there's been a lot of research on this, and we're going to do a session on hearts at some point. But certainly we know that when people are breathing at closest to their resonant frequency, they have not only the most psychological well-being, but they have by far the least health issues across the board. It's a fascinating area of research. And it sounds to me like that's what you were doing with them, getting them to that resonant frequency. And then, of course, very sadly, when COVID stopped all of this and they could no longer attain that, ill health came.
That's interesting what you say, Jerry, and you too, Ross, that in that time of not being able to communicate, that language that is there doesn't flow. And we often say, well, a patient needs a therapist, or a patient needs a doctor, or a client needs a psychologist. The psychologist also needs the client. The doctor needs the patient. And that is where you can see where, when that communication that Hippocrates called indeed this sacred flow in between that dyad, when that has stopped functioning in the larger medical field, but also in the interhuman relationship with the patient, because that takes time and that takes a stepping back. And I always feel that if you look after a person or you do psychotherapy, you don't actually do much. It is that time in between the sessions, which is a bit like reading between the lines or listening to the interval in music. That is actually where the essence is. The tone is the outer finite building of it. But the in between these tones, that is where it actually lives. And so when people say, I can read between the lines, and that's where, for instance, my parents said that they became during the war so clever in reading what was actually meant without saying it. So that's what I want to say, that point of between low tide and high tide, that infinitesimally small moment where it is actually nothing or all, whatever. And then you have this turnaround, the same as in the breathing, the same as in the being, the diastole and the systole of the heart.
I feel it's time for a piece of music. What do you think?
Yep.
I think that sounds wonderful, Jerry.
So, yes, let's have a listen to The Balance by the Moody Blues. How very appropriate.
You're listening to Real People with Jerry Pives right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
So that was The Balance by the Moody Blues. So I am wondering about the addictive nature of bad news for us all. Have you anything you'd like to say about that, Renee?
Yeah, I think we have in us the one way of really the striving to health, but there is also the striving to destruction. And that is what, and it's a question of balance, that as long as I'm aware of that, I can work with that. I can make a free choice. That is the free human being. But Freud talks about the death wish. And it was very interesting for me that how I experienced that myself. When I was in Zimbabwe and I worked there for 4 years, and I went to the Victoria Falls quite frequently because it wasn't so far away. And I walked there then, and there was a path very close to the edge. And that path was actually blocked off. And that's probably why I wanted to go there. And then because I wanted, and this is, of course, ridiculous, I wanted to look over the edge, to look into this abyss, really. And so you're absolutely soaking wet because of the spray from the Victoria Falls. There is a continuous rainbow. And I was then, for the first time in my life, that I actually we stand here and see a 360 degree rainbow. And I wanted to then go and look over the edge. So I don't know if you can see me, but I was creeping a bit forward. And of course, the grass is as wet as anything. So what you do is you become really quite fearful and curious at the same time. And then you come to a point, and I was very aware of that, that you almost feel, I want to fly, I want to fly, I want to fly. And that is that instinct of where I think many people come when they come to a point of suicide, when they actually give in to that death wish. And I think a lot of sensation seeking is almost that wish for destruction in ourselves that is fighting against the wish to be healthy. It's again this equilibrium. The human being can do that because we're conscious of it. When I was as a lumberjack in Canada, worked there for 4 months or so, and then I went on filming bears and beavers, and then you actually creep up to these bears, but you are very aware, I'm in your territory. We didn't have any gun or any weapon with us in order to ask permission, as it were. And then you see that a bear comes up to you on his four legs, sniffing you, and coming further to a point where his curiosity and his fear come in equilibrium. He stands up, and then he runs off. Meaning that if you were to suddenly appear in front of that animal instead of very slowly going there, or that animal coming towards you, then he would otherwise have lost face and he could only attack. Mm. But by coming that way and not having any intrusion, also not having any intrusive thoughts, the animal can actually make a retreat. And I think that's how animals work. With us, I think it has to do with our consciousness, that we become aware of something, and we become aware of what is becoming stronger, this wish for sensation, this wish for news, or my knowing it's not good for you, and somehow making the choice.
Mm. So we're discussing this addictive attraction of bad news. And René, you've linked it very much with this dynamic between life and death, and all the way back to Freud's Thanatos or Mortido, the idea that we have this. And of course, he was writing a great deal of his material on this immediately after the First World War. It was actually in some of his later writings, but it was after the horrors of the apparent death wish of the First World War. But I wonder, there's another way of looking at it, isn't there, Roz, which is the way we're hardwired for survival in terms of being alert to threat. I wonder, do you want to talk about that at all?
Yes, very happy to. It comes back to that point that our entire sort of physiology evolved, or I certainly believe it evolved, from a time 200,000 years ago when our lives were constantly in peril, whether it was bears that you have mentioned, René. And by the way, I often wonder, listening to you, if there is a job that you haven't done. You're incredible at the experiences you've had. But when we had those real threats, those very real physical threats, whether it was the animals, whether it was other tribes that were trying to take your territory, and then certainly things like weather events, because 200,000 years ago, a massive thunderstorm or tsunami or those things that we now have scientific explanations for, they were incredibly frightening and escalating. And so even though now we live in a very different world where most of our threats are actually not physical, our entire physiology still responds to any threat in a way that's physical. And our biases, so we have very strong psychological biases to look for threat. That's what the amygdala's job is. We've talked about that before. A very primitive part of our brain that we share with all animals. That
Sorry for interrupting here, just out of joking, where you say where we now have scientific explanations for.
Mm.
We can explain part of that. Mm. We can explain part of a rainbow, the physical sides of the rainbow. But there's far more to a rainbow. Just like I can take your height and weight and look at your color of your eyes. But that is not Ross.
Mm.
It's only one manifestation. Okay, sorry.
Yes, 100%. Where was I?
The amygdala. You were at the amygdala.
Yes, so the amygdala, which when I describe this to children, I call it the body's security guard. And it is sitting there waiting for danger. And the second that it does sense danger, and that for a child these days tends not to be bears, it could be another child in the school who gives them an angry look or something as simple, not simple, but less physically dangerous than that. But the body still responds the same way. The heart instantly speeds up. I'm not sure if the listeners are aware, we actually, going back to the heart, our resting heart rate of 60, etc., beats per minute is our heart rate with the brake applied. We actually have what's called the intrinsic heart rate, which I think is double or more than that. So that if we are faced with a threat, the brake is taken off the heart and it can suddenly pull our resources together. It will send the blood to the major muscle groups, to our arms and to our legs so that we can fight or run away. And of course, that's not useful if it is dealing with a child who is angry with us at school or if it's dealing with very fearful information in the media. Unfortunately, when it takes those resources and sends blood to the major muscle groups, it takes it away from our prefrontal cortex, which is the part that can rationally deal with the information. So again, it's having that understanding and that self-awareness that your body wasn't designed as it was to deal with 21st century stress. It's still operating as though there's lions and tigers and bears ready to take your life.
It's interesting that when you look at what people, the vaccine injury people, they all talk about mostly about the tachycardia that they get, this racing of the heart. And of course, the main, well, if you look at all the side effects of the jabs, the biggest side effect is to get COVID. That is well known.
Yeah, because right.
Yes, I think everybody over two injections and a booster has up to, I think, 8 or 10 times as much chance of going over it. And we see that at the moment, all the sickness and still the COVID being around. But how it affects the heart as the center of our harmony, the center of our equilibrium. Mm. So that's one thing that I wanted to say. The second thing is if I would look at the amygdala, as you say, it is almost waiting, sitting there waiting for alarm, waiting for some trigger. Do you think if there would be no danger, if there would not be any alarm symptoms, would the hippocampus and the amygdala actually atrophy? Would it become smaller? Would it be happier or unhappier if there would be no sensation, no danger?
If there was no alarm, what sprung to mind here for me is what happens to those subcortical areas, those defensive areas for children or even going back to in utero. So babies that are growing in a mother's womb, when the mother is experiencing extreme stress, the body, once again, trying to seek balance and safety, will actually send more resources and the body will prepare the child for coming out into a world that is more threatening. So these children, and these were the ones I worked with, tend to have almost like an alarm system that's more finely tuned. It's seeing a lot more danger than is actually existing. So certainly, if you have been exposed to a huge amount of trauma, of frightening material, you can, rather than atrophy, it actually becomes hypervigilant. It becomes stronger.
When there is danger, yeah.
When there is danger.
The interesting thing about this is when you mention the hippocampus as the seat of the memory, and we talked a little bit, didn't we, about the hippocampus last time, we do know that when someone is depressed and they are doing less and they are less activated and they are more and more kind of shut down, that I think up to about 16 or 17% of the hippocampus disappears. I mean, literally. And they are less able to, because the hippocampus primary is connected with memory. It's not all of memory, but it's certainly a part of memory. And the hippocampus, if people can't remember or make good memories, it's like if the hippocampus is reduced, then the ability to, as it were, remind ourselves, to get a perspective, to say, you know, I'm having a hard day today, but yesterday was a great day. But if I can't remember yesterday was a great day, I'm going to feel like what I'm stuck in is forever. So in answer to your question, Renny, it's really interesting because I think when someone is in a state of overwhelm and they become rather like the thyroid gland, they have worked and worked and worked until buggery, if I could use that word, until they're absolutely exhausted. And then what happens is they go into that depressed state where they've got no energy, the thyroid perhaps isn't working, the adrenals are probably not working. Adrenal exhaustion is another, rather like the thyroid, it's another of those glands that is so important. And so we have this kind of situation where the trauma, the fear, the anxiety wears down all the systems of the body. And actually what's very interesting about that is if we start to shut down, I suspect, and I've got no evidence for this apart from the hippocampus research, I suspect a lot of us will atrophy. Like if we don't get out and exercise, the muscles atrophy. I don't know. I'm just riffing off some ideas that you've asked for, Renny.
Because with depression, for instance, and it's interesting that you bring that in contact with the thyroid, because one of the treatments, it's not a main treatment, but it's actually to give thyroid hormone for people who are depressed and if nothing else seems to help. But what do you find with depression? It is as if the temperature goes down and down. Everything freezes. The metabolic processes freeze. The cognition is less. Their attention is less. Their concentration. And that's exactly why it's also called the pseudo-dementia, that people are actually fearful of, am I now becoming dement because I can't remember so well? And that is part of the depression. And that's in itself also for the listeners really important to realize, no, they're not going dement, but it is that slowing down of all these life processes. So that, yes.
I really want to bring this conversation to the issue that we were touching on before, which is what you said, Roz, was you shared that you've noticed you yourself have been dropping into much more the hypo state, the lower state of activation, the state of kind of freeze, or we sometimes call it flop. We also sometimes just call it, I like to call it shutting down, a shutdown. And I also have felt that over these last 6 months, almost as if I've said this elsewhere, I think, that I thought that with everything that happened with COVID, I was in a battle and I felt that for that battle, I had to sprint. And I was a 100-meter sprinter. So there I was sprinting like crazy. But then I got to the end of the 100 meters and it was still going on. So I made myself sprint again. And suddenly I found myself not in a sprint at all, but I'm sprinting a marathon. And all of this is about exhaustion and burnout and all those things. And then I got to the end of the marathon and I was told to go and start the second marathon immediately. And so this is like a burnout of so many systems in what makes us human. We can talk about each one individually, but so many systems that make us beautifully human have just become overwhelmed. And I'm very aware in myself, Roz, that I'm having to really take great care to anything that I say yes to. Yes. It's as if I've got to say no more than I've ever said before in my life. Mm-hmm. And I've got to be very cautious about my yeses because I need to pace myself for and rest my body. My body needs rest. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to share that, really, because I think you were very brave to mention what you mentioned, Roz.
Thank you, because what you described, by the way, is exactly what Melanie Klein, one of the very early psychoanalyst, she talks about the manic defense. Mm-hmm. And so what you did, that you felt, I need to sprint, that's actually hardly a question of free choice. Mm-hmm. It is a compulsion to do that. Mm-hmm. Just like people who become manic are being controlled by this heightened emotional state, often as a result of stress or as trauma. And that is a well-known thing. It's called the manic defense. And I think if we realize that as psychologists and as doctors, then we can actually try to bring this down and look at it as, again, it's the trauma that is the basis. And we've all been traumatized in these last 4 years.
Yes, we certainly have. I think for me, what you've both said really resonates. For me, I didn't want, and I still don't want this to be marathon after marathon. There was this piece of me that absolutely believed if just enough people understood what was going on, then we could sort of hand on the baton to those people as they were finding out. But that hasn't happened. And it comes back to what we were talking about last week, was that the battle here isn't about constantly trying to wake other folk up, as it were. It's about making sure we're looking after ourselves and that we are resonating at a frequency of love and care. And from there, that's where the power is. That's where we can really bring about change. But it's easier said than done, isn't it?
I think that for that to come, for that healing to really come, we talked briefly about that with the Truth and Reconciliation Committee that you mentioned last time. We have all been traumatized, and it still continues as long as the truth is not really coming out, as long as there is still untruth sold as truth or political prowess instead of honesty. As long as that, we know inside that we need to be still in a state of alarm, and then we can get controlled. It's a bit like, you know, who are the most active and doing most physical exercises are people, women with eating disorders. And that is of the, and they actually come in the combination of not eating and compensating with so much over excessive exercise. Okay. That's also why their whole electrolytes come into danger, and they get low potassium levels. And it's actually one of the most serious mental illnesses, if you want to look at that from a physical point of view, because the heart cannot cope with it and stops. So what comes out in all of these talks that we have, that you can actually not separate the body from the soul, or the body from the mental, emotional, and spiritual aspects, because that makes us human. And if the social aspect is taken out in the COVID, then we suffer, and we suffer physically and emotionally. And what do? We go into overactivity or underactivity. We drink too much, all of these things, in order to compensate what is actually our equilibrium, to come back to that.
And ultimately, it's making things worse. Sadly, the quick fix, which if it worked in an ideal way, it would fix things, but it doesn't at all. And I think you were talking before, René, about the importance of having meals together when we were talking about window of tolerance. And I think a really clear example of the way the body works in this is that there's a lot of research that shows if you eat your dinner in front of a TV, screen or on your own, your entire digestive system works differently to if you eat your food slowly and with company. So as you say, it's not that we're just shoveling nutrition in. It's an experience that impacts our entire balance, our entire homeostasis.
It's always in all religious and in all cultures, actually, it is a spiritual event. It isn't there are religious laws of what to eat and what not to eat, as it influences our spiritual and emotional being, also our social being. So Elizabeth and I always, it's just the two of us, but we eat around the table. We have that in still Central European thing that we eat at lunchtime, our main meal. We have nothing before that, and then that's our first meal. We say a little grace, and we then have the dinner. And then, so there is something holding that. There is it is an event that is important, and it's different from sitting in front of the TV and munching McDonald's.
I am fascinated by the way in which this conversation is going and has gone today. I'm particularly interested in, you know, the difference, for example, you know, between shoveling food in and being mindful. Even if you're on your own, it's possible to be mindful and to think about connections with other people. I want to say that because many of our listeners may be living on their own. And it's a time where we can, in some sense, bring the family that we are a part of, whether that's friendship groups or whatever, that can be brought into the sacredness of the meal that you described so beautifully, Rene. And I am also thinking how this is all about. I'd like to know what you think today has been about, because it's time for us to begin to wrap up our session. I'd like us to play music at the end as well. But this has all been about, well, this has been about a lot of things, but one of the things that strikes me is I'm built much more for, my body shape is much more for sprinting than it is for marathons. Because a marathon body is much more exoskeletal. It's longer, thinner, you know, it's a kind of a more of a lighter build. Whereas the sprinter has to be muscular and strong. But when I began to run marathons, I learned a great deal about going slowly, about readying myself, about pacing myself, about, it was actually much harder to run a marathon than to train for a sprinting, although I think professional sprinters would disagree, obviously. But what I'm getting at here is there was a different mindset for the marathon than for the sprinting. And I want to invite the listeners to think of themselves as preparing for a marathon. And that means a change of equipment. That means a change of mentality. It means a whole change in the way in which we take care of ourselves, just like we've had to learn about viruses and governments and goodness knows what, we've become experts in so many things. We're now being invited, I believe, by what we're going through right now. I believe we're being invited to become even more mindful and aware of what we really are. And, you know, I come back to Africa and I come back to that tribe that had produced, you know, in Kenya, the Kenyan marathon runners and the Maasai tribe. These people were able to run beautifully and for as long as they wished. And they just trained themselves for that sense of continuity. And they such a spiritual element to that tribe in particular. Everything I've come across, and I'm no expert, but everything about them strikes me as profoundly authentic and truthful and spiritual. You know, those are my projections, and I think they might be half accurate, actually. So I just wanted to say that this is, these times are tough, but we can shift our view of it by saying, what am I being invited to learn? Maybe I would never have grown, and I think this is true of me, I would never be here doing this program if it hadn't been for the fuster cluck that's been going on for the last 4 years.
Yep.
What do you think we've been talking about, Rennie? What struck you about our session today? What has stayed with you, really, from our session? The same for you, Ros. I mean, you don't have to answer in any order, but I wonder what you think it's been about for you, really, for each of us.
For me, in a nutshell, again, it's coming back to that place of awareness. Of awareness, as you say, Jerry, that this is a marathon we're having to deal with. And therefore, keeping our physical and psychological balance is critical. And by being aware of where we're feeling, how we're feeling, checking in regularly, then we can stay in that window of tolerance that I was talking about before and be in the best possible state we can to handle whatever comes our way. I'd also like to quickly make a suggestion. I've had so many parents writing to me over the last few years about how to help their children manage these sorts of concepts, manage this really difficult time. And there's a fantastic program called Zones of Regulation. And it's all about teaching these concepts to children and empowering them to check in on themselves in this way, to notice if they're in a state of hypoarousal or hyperarousal, although it uses much simpler terms. It uses a color system and gives them tools, helps them choose which tools might be best for me if I'm in a contracted, what they call a blue zone. And then if I'm becoming very escalated, what are the tools? Because everyone's different. We won't all have the same tools. So it not only gives the children the awareness, but it also empowers them, gives them the choice, gives them the capacity to really get into that driver's seat and not be so overwhelmed by all of life, which is very overwhelming.
Yeah, so that has come through in this session in many, many ways, that awareness and freedom are intrinsically connected. And for that, for awareness, you need to inform yourself, to experience, to, and that's very important for a child, because you were talking about a child, that a child can also be child and experience the colors, the smells, the textures of the earth, how it feels when you fall down and you graze your knee, that when you go through childhood illnesses, that you really experience in order to get this wide sense of, I am a human being growing up for this life in which I have the possibility to have the freedom to choose, the freedom to serve, the freedom to associate with people or not to associate with people. And that comes from that wholeness that we have as human being, standing in the upright, in the letter I, the vertical letter I. The more I can be I as a sense of, as part of us, the more I can really become who I am and not be controlled. And I think those things came to the fore today.
Well, I want to say a big thank you to you both. And I'm wondering what piece of music we'd like to sign out with from our babbling conversations today. Any suggestions?
Ross's Here Comes the Sun.
Yes, that was exactly what I've got goosebumps. That was exactly what I was going to say.
Well, on that uplifting note, because at the end of the day, because we're human, we have a spirit of incredible light and power within us that I believe it's a good note to end, that here comes the sun. And the sun does keep reappearing, I've noticed. Every day I notice it keeps reappearing. What a wonderful thing that is.
A wonderful thing.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.